Welcome back to Sounds Like Canada on CBC Radio 1. My name's Sheila Rogers. In February of 2003, Imogen Maher was born premature at 1 pound 8 ounces, just big enough to fit in the palm of her dad's hand. SARS was at its height in Toronto. It took months before Imogen's siblings were allowed into the hospital to see their new sister. Nicola Maher is Imogen's mother, and for her, Imogen's struggle took on the aura of an epic battle, one in which a tiny warrior, that would be Imogen, was cared for by a wizard and dedicated bodyguards. These characters form the basis for Nicola's book. It's called The Tiniest Warrior of All, and Nicola Maher is with me this morning, along with one of the people who inspired the characters in the book. Dr. Elizabeth Astor is a neonatal doctor at Women's College Hospital in Toronto and is affectionately known as the Wizard. And so Mum and Wizard are with me. We're hoping for one of the bodyguards to enter any moment, the nurse Cheryl Phillips, but I think the traffic in Toronto is just prohibiting her at the moment. Anyway, welcome to the two of you.
Thank you.
Nicola, take me back to the 11th of February 2003 and that day.
Well, it started off just like a regular day. I'd had a bit very busy few weeks, and I'd been thinking over the weekend that maybe I wasn't feeling the baby moving so much. But I just figured it was one of those things. I wasn't really going to get wound up about it. But I just went for a routine checkup, and then at the routine checkup, some questions were raised because they couldn't feel Imogen's heartbeat very much. It kept stopping and starting, and so, you know, they tell you the bad news that actually she's very, very, very tiny and very, very, very weak, and put you in an ambulance and whisk you straight down to Women's College Hospital.
Then what happened?
It was all very quick. I had a brief chat with one of the doctors there, and within an hour, Imogen was born. And she weighed 1.5 pounds, 685 grams when she was born.
What did you think?
It seemed like the worst possible nightmare you can imagine. I just assumed the worst. They told me that probably when she was born she wouldn't cry, but actually she did cry, which gave me a lot of hope. It gave me the fact that she had the energy to cry, because she was very sickly indeed. And virtually immediately upon being born, she had to have a blood transfusion. And and then I didn't see her for a few hours then, because I was in recovery, until they wheeled me out on the bed. They wheel you out on these big beds in the teeny tiny unit to go see her in her incubator.
Do you remember your first thought at looking at her?
I do, and it was a really really powerful moment. I was feeling absolutely without hope and dreadful, and could not believe that this was really happening. And they wheel me in to see the baby, and she looks awful. I mean, she looks like an alien. She's, you know, she's all red and skinny and bones, and she has this big distended tummy, and she looks so weak. And they put down the side of the incubator for me to actually put my hand in and touch her. And I didn't think I would be allowed to touch her, but I put my finger in, and Imogen, her little hand, squeezed my finger. And I felt from that moment always that she was reassuring me. Like, she was the strong one, and she had this amazing fighting spirit. And it's from the moment we connected, I was really aware that this was a teeny tiny, frail body, but the spirit within it was massive, and that gave me incredible hope about her as a person.
As you describe, you're reaching in, I'm thinking of the Michelangelo
finger.
It's just amazing.
Yeah, it is.
Liz, from the medical point of view, and I know that there's just so much more, but what kind of risk was Imogen facing at that point?
Imogen was a baby that we would have classified as small for gestational age. So in other words, she was much smaller than, much smaller than what we normally expect at about 27 weeks. When you think that the median or the average weight for a baby who is at 27 weeks to be a kilo, she was about 350 grams less, so she was quite small. And as a baby who's 27 weeks, they still have to deal with specific issues of breathing and making the adjustments to outside life. But we know that those particular babies have even more difficulties with the adaptation. They have difficulties with sugars. They can't maintain sugars, their own sugar level very well. They have trouble with their heat maintenance. Feeding becomes issues. So there's a lot of things we had to anticipate in her case. And then we also have to take into consideration what were the circumstances that led to the delivery and to such an immediate decision to deliver, and were those circumstances going to contribute to some degree as to whether she was going to adapt well enough to the outside or not.
What were you thinking?
When I first saw her, she was doing reasonably okay for a baby who was that size. I mean, keeping in perspective all the challenges that we have to anticipate over the next 48 to 72 hours and thereafter. But she was a feisty little critter, as I told John and Nicola, and that has to be always there. You have to keep in mind that for whatever reason, she fought her way to be here, and you have to give her that chance. And that's what we kind of did.
When did it dawn on you, Nicola, that she was the littlest warrior?
That was something that happened fairly early on because, Lydia and Henry, my other two children, had seen pictures of their sister and they were like, "Mum, you've given birth to an alien." I mean, that's awful, because they're not pretty, these babies. And they look so frail and passive. And what became really obvious to me was that these children are amazingly strong people. They're just trapped in these very weak bodies, and the medical job is to get the bodies to the state of where their mental capacity is. So it was very important to me to explain to my other two that their sister was not passive, that she was fighting the battle of her life with all the other babies there, and because I didn't know what the outcome was going to be. So I wanted whatever happened, even if she were not to win her battle, I wanted her life to have meant something that they could respect in her. And also, it has to be something pretty good if your parents suddenly disappear off the face of the earth to go spend all their days with an alien that you don't know. You know, there has to be some logical explanation. So I wanted to be... I'm very much in favour of having to be honest with the children. I didn't want to say to them, "Don't worry, everything's going to be okay," because quite honestly, that may not be the case. And I wanted to say to them, it's okay to be frightened, because actually in this situation, being frightened is a very realistic reaction. But this is a way that I could find a fairy tale. It was a way I could find of telling them the truth, but putting it in a way that they could understand. So I tried to mythologize what was actually going on so that they could process it better, so that I could still be honest with them.
How close is the fairy tale to reality, though? I had a friend who delivered a premature baby, mm-hmm. too, and I've been in the neonatal ward, and it is a place of miracles ongoing.
It is. There is nothing in the book that didn't happen. Everything in that book is clinically accurate. Although, the original book was much, much bigger. But for the format, I have to cut it down a lot. So there's lots of episodes which, I've simplified quite a bit. But, the whole everything that happens in the book is technically accurate.
Is there a reading you might want to do from the book?
Oh,
You can think about it.
Yeah, I could do. Okay. I could do a reading from the book.
One of the things that struck me, and Liz, you just explained it, but was sort of the search for the magic elixir that would keep the baby going.
And, is that the sorcerer?
The sorcerer, and how important that was. That there was, and gradually that distended belly of the littlest warrior started.
Well, again, too. That was all stemming from when we alluded to that she would have feeding problems, mm-hmm. because, again, she was a small for gestational age baby, so we know that that group of babies tend to have what we call a more exaggerated preemie gut. And that's what the sorcerer was talking about, is that we just have to get that gut moving. And that's where the magical elixir came
in. Well, yeah, and the motion potion is actually suppositories. But I just felt that somehow that wasn't as poetic.
Right.
So I thought motion potion.
You found something, Nicola.
Yeah, now this part of the book is to do with, I guess before having a baby in intensive care, I'd always looked at children with physical and mental disabilities and felt kind of sorry for them. But having been in the unit and realized what these children in this situation have gone through, I was just filled with this most amazing respect for their courage and the strength of people that they are, that actually the fact that they've been able to survive, lesser people wouldn't be able to survive what they've been through. So now they've got these physical or mental disabilities, but that makes them champions who are more than us. And so this is a part of the book where the sorcerer... So basically the tiniest warrior is having to travel, because that's another scary thing that these premature children have to do. So she's had to travel to go to this other kingdom, and she sees these other warriors there, and she wants to know from the sorcerer who are all these other people. When she got to Nunnigan, Sorcerer Ayn was waiting for her. "I hear you have been sent by Flynn, the Lord Protector, on a quest to find your true home," he said. "Take this motion potion. It will help you to eat and grow." The tiny warrior did as she was told, and then looked around her. To her amazement, she saw many different kinds of warrior in Nunnigan. Sorcerer Ayn explained, "Here we look after many travellers who have crashed. They are all champions with special powers. Many have injuries from their battles. Some have lost their eyesight or hearing, or else their bodies work in different ways. These are wounds they have received while fighting to fulfill their own quests. They are among the bravest people in the world. Those we cannot save return as glorious heroes to their own kingdoms. They lose the troubles and pains they fought with in this kingdom, and they are happy."
Bravo! You're reading from the tiniest warrior of all. This is Nicola Maher, and she has cast as the wizard Dr. Elizabeth Astolos, and you're listening to Sounds Like Canada on CBC Radio 1. How did you feel when you found out you were cast as a wizard?
A little bit surprised, but I had only read the script, so... I thought it was actually quite cute, and I was actually very proud that she had taken the opportunity to do that. What was probably more, was more interesting was the fact that the person who drew the pictures somehow got my blonde hair all down to a T. So that was quite, I thought, wow. And he had never met me.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Not to give anything away, but it's quite a shade of blonde.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I have that shade of blonde underneath my brown hair. The cast of characters, and if can you give us just a little sense of the story, Nicola?
Yeah, the story is set around a tiny warrior who is given a quest that she has to find her true home, and the element that guides her through this whole thing is the sound of this beautiful music. So there's this beautiful music that she is following in order to lead her towards where she should be going. So she gets in this fabulous time machine, which called Bertha. So, which
nice pun.
Yeah, which crashes into this strange kingdom. So she is in this strange kingdom. She doesn't know what's going to happen to her. She feels like she's not going to make it. And then the wizard Astolos comes and takes her to the miracle factory and guides her through the things that she needs to do in order to fulfill her quest and find her true home.
The miracle factory is a really good way to put it. And the developments that seem to be being made in neonatal mm-hmm. care are phenomenal. I don't want to ask any what if questions because they're just too terrifying to think about. But what can be done now is phenomenal.
It can be, but we also have to recognize that we sometimes have our limitations. Mm-hmm. And I think that we try to share that with parents that although we are able to help a number of infants, we sometimes may not win the battle. And we may try, and it's a balance of many mm-hmm. things. And we have to recognize that sometimes we have nature that we have to deal with mm-hmm. as well.
But now are younger and younger preemies, they've got a better chance than ever.
I would say that that's probably true to babies up to about 25 weeks. But when we go below 25 weeks, we still have to recognize that there's an element of immaturity that sometimes we may not be able mm-hmm. to overcome, and we don't always win that battle. So once you get below 25, but more so under 24, I think we tend to be far more cautious and guarded in that respect.
How do you determine whether it's fair for the baby or not good for the baby?
That's not always easy. Yeah. Sometimes parents may have certain beliefs that help guide us. Sometimes when we don't have clear directions, we sometimes have to sort of go one step at a time. When that happens, I usually say to parents, let the babies tell us what direction they want to take us. And then if it becomes clear, then we know where we're going. And we take it one day at a time with some of the smaller babies. We probably don't take that same approach with the bigger babies, but I always counsel parents that nothing's ever 100% because it isn't.
Nicola, how did you deal with that, or did you, while you were in the ward?
Oh, I don't know. I think John and I were the absolute nightmare parents from a neonatologist's point of view, because we were just obsessively worried, and we used to trail the staff like puppy dogs, like they had their own personal stalkers. And it was being in your own worst nightmare. And then on top of that, when you think things aren't bad enough, then the SARS crisis hits. But I think what became really obvious to me and what gave me a lot of comfort was, you know, you're unlucky to have a premature child. But having taken that as a given, after that, there was so much luck in what happened to us. It could have been so much, much worse. And we are so lucky the way it showed. Like, we were in the best place ever that she could have been at. The Women's College Hospital specializes in small premature babies. They're like, and they take, the care that Imogen received there was more than, I expect a certain level of professional competence from qualified doctors, but the staff at Women's College Hospital, it was beyond that. It was like a personal interest in every child that was there, not just my little angel. It was, you know, all of the babies. And so I knew that we were in the place where if a miracle can happen, it would. And I got a lot of comfort from knowing that she was in the best possible place she could be. Didn't stop me being a total nightmare.
She wasn't that bad.
I wasn't that good either.
As you pulled away from that time a little bit, I mean, mm-hmm. of course, it will always be with you. Mm-hmm. Are there ethical arguments ever in your own mind about?
Yes.
Yeah.
It took me a long while to think that she would be saved. And to me, looking at her, it just didn't seem to be very likely that she would be saved. But then the thought enters your mind, well, okay, maybe they might save her, but what will they have saved? What will her quality of life be? What kind of care will she need if she is very, you know, disabled in some way, or you know, has problems in some way? And you can't get away from it. You're in the situation. It's not a rational debate, because here's your child. who you love desperately, and you want to bring her home. But on the other hand, what are you going to bring home? And I think the other thing that I got great comfort from was knowing that although she was exceptionally small and she had these particular issues, in the weird world of Women's College Hospital, she was kind of normal. And you know, Dr. Stelos had this crystal ball, and she would always say to me, well, you know, this is what's likely to happen, because she's seen other babies like this, whereas in another place you might not have seen other babies like this. And she'd say, well, you know, this is what's likely to happen, this is going to be the next issue. And sure enough, you know, the crystal ball was always correct, and that helped too. So when these things that I thought were terrible happened, Dr. Stelos would say, well, yeah, that's kind of what we thought might happen. And that helped too, I suppose.
So you can map it to a certain extent.
For some babies, yes. You can at least sort of know what the natural expectation is, but you always have to be prepared that a baby's going to make a left turn instead of a right turn, and that left turn may not have the roadblock and go off the cliff. So you always have to be prepared that it's not going to necessarily go the way you would like it to go. But if you have an understanding of what the natural course may be for a baby, then you can be a bit proactive, you can anticipate problems, you can prepare parents for certain things, because you know that it's likely to happen down the next few days or whatever.
But when it changes, it can change so quickly.
It can, and that's why you always have to be prepared that the wrong turn may take, and it may not be a good turn, or it may be just an off turn, but we can get right back on track.
How is she now? How's Imogen now?
She is great. She's, you know, we're very, very lucky with her. She's still very small, but she makes up for that in attitude. So she's now around about 2.5, and you know, she definitely rules the roost. And she was having a major temper tantrum yesterday, and you know, behaving very poorly. And so that's the other advantage of having her, you know, for the first 4 months of her life in a neonatal unit. I look at my husband and I said, oh, that's obviously something she picked up in the unit. She didn't get that behavior from us
at some coffee clutch with the other preemies.
I said, she didn't get that from us, she must have picked that up at the hospital.
But at a certain level, I bet you embrace those moments too, where she's screaming and having a tantrum. And
I think having Imogen, having children full stop changes your life, but having Imogen and the battles that she went through really, really makes me appreciate the small things in life, and really makes me, it's changed my whole world outlook to really, really value those small things that happen, because they are what makes the big picture in the end.
What do you hope people will take from your book?
I hope that, given the number of premature babies that are being born, I hope that other families can use this to help support them as they go through this whole experience. It's such a mind-blowing experience for the parents, and then you think about the knock-on effect for the siblings. And I'd like the siblings to know that they're involved and they are important, and to understand some of these huge issues that we've been talking about, to help them to understand that and come to terms with that.
Can we talk about what the beautiful sound was that the tiniest warrior
heard? Well, as the tiniest warrior is getting better, and she's able to see and all the rest of it, and she finds beside her incubator some eyes very like her own, and when they she realizes that the sound of the music is actually the sound of the laughter of her brothers and sisters, then she knows she's home.
It's a very lovely book, and it's wonderful to meet the two of you, Wizard Liz the Wiz and Nicola. Thank you so much. It's going to be so cool, and you can read that to Imogen.
Well, she still looks at it now and goes, oh, that's me, that's Imogen.
Lovely. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.